How can you better support your patient's brain health? Tune into our FX Medicine Perspectives Forum, a live panel discussion packed with clinical pearls on hormones, movement, the gut-brain axis, and more. Watch the recording by logging into bioceuticals.com.au/education and walk away with practical insights you can use in clinic right away.
Welcome to FX Medicine by Bioceuticals, where we bring you the latest in evidence-based, integrative, functional, and complementary medicine. We begin today by acknowledging the traditional custodians of land on which we gather and pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples here today and wherever you are listening from. I'm Emma Sutherland, and I'm thrilled to be joined by my co-host for part two of a panel discussion on the complex topic of cardiometabolic health. I'm joined by my fellow FX Medicine ambassadors, Dr. Adrian Lopresti, Lisa Costabile, Dr. Michelle Woolhouse, and Mick Alexander. Welcome back, everyone.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
In part one, we busted some myths, covered the pathophysiology involved in cardiometabolic disease, the assessment measures we use in our own clinics, and finish by highlighting key cardiometabolic hijackers. In part two, we'll discuss treatment options, not only traditional treatment options, but also the treatments each of us has discovered through our clinical expertise and bring these to life via a case study. We'll end today with our favourite resources to use with patients. Now, when it comes to medications and treatment of cardiometabolic disease, I think the biggest change we've all seen in the last couple of years is the use of GLP-1 receptor agonists. I really want to dive into this, pick your brains on their use. What do we need to be more aware of? What does the research say? And how do we counsel our patients around their use? Lisa, I'm going to start with you first. What are you seeing clinically?
So I've got a fair few clients using the GLP-1 receptor agonists, and many of these patients have tried and struggled with nutrition interventions, intermittent fasting, low carb, high protein, low fat, low calorie. We've all had patients like this that have spent years and years doing different dietary interventions and still struggle with their weight. So while diet and lifestyle interventions will always be the primary therapeutic, I think, for all of us as an intervention, we have to acknowledge that many clients find it really difficult to lose weight solely with diet and lifestyle, usually because the behavioural aspect kind of takes over. So for me, GLP-1 agonists, if they are to be used, they're just another tool to add in. They don't replace the healthy eating, the exercise, the adequate sleep, the stress management, all the things we've talked about in part one. And GLP-1s were never designed to just be taken without changing the diet, which I think is really important for patients to understand. Probably the main concern I have, and something I think practitioners need to be aware of, is that the reduction in appetite that occurs when using GLP-1s can lead to under-eating, and thus patients often find themselves with undernutrition, which I think can be problematic because even though they're losing weight, they're actually becoming more unwell because of this lack of nutrients. A recent 2025 study observed that in individuals with type 2 diabetes who had been using the GLP-1s for 1 year, over 20% of individuals had nutritional deficiencies and loss of muscle mass. So for us as practitioners, I think it's really important to be doing a big overview on what they're eating and making sure that we are ensuring that their nutritional intake is adequate, even if they are eating less. Now, on the flip side, one of the best features of GLP-1s, my clients report, and I think I probably agree with this, is the reduction in food noise that they experience. So those constant intrusive thoughts and cravings about food, even though they might not actually be hungry. So from this perspective, I find them very helpful. They seem to work by impacting areas of the brain involved with regulation of appetite and reward-seeking behaviours, including the hypothalamus. So in the research, we're seeing increased dopaminergic activity in that reward phase. When they're eating, there is pleasure and satisfaction, but there is no increase in that pursuit phase, which is why the food intake and the cravings are reduced. And I think we see with these patients who binge eat and have obesity, that often those reward pathways can be altered, which is why they have problems just sticking to the diet recommendations that we make. So I think for me, this is an area where GLP-1s work very, very well. Research also recently published shows that they may reduce cravings and consumption for alcohol in alcoholics. So going back to what Michelle was saying about in part one about alcohol being a huge contributor to cardiometabolic disease, I think a lot of my patients may be able to sometimes do the diet part, but then the alcohol part takes over. So I'm excited about the GLP-1 use, but of course they need to be used integratively and safely. What about you, Em? What are you finding in your clinic?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, they've been around long enough now that I've been able to zoom out and get a bit of a macro view for them and a macro feel for them. The first thing I want to do is counsel my patient around the weight. How much do they want to lose? And then the why. What's their why in losing that weight? Because if they don't identify that, then when they come off it, it's really not going to work as well as what they want. I always discuss realistic expectations that they still need to exercise, they still need to eat well. And I actually don't like a weight loss of more than 0.5 kilogram per week, because I feel that anything more than that really doesn't work well from a set point perspective. So I explain that set point theory to them. And I say, you know, having a small amount of weight loss regularly and consistently is okay, because people hear the stories about, I lost 4 kilos in a week. It's not what we're aiming for. I do want to do a bit of gut preparation, because if there's any intestinal permeability, SIBO, anything like that, that is only going to become exacerbated with the slowdown in motility. And then I'm always discussing before they start the medication what the plan will be when they offboard the medication, because that rebound weight is real. It happens most of the time, but there's a few caveats that I've been able to work out where we can reduce the risk of that rebound weight. The first thing, as you mentioned, the food noise really gets dialed down when they're on these medications, which means when they're coming off them, the food noise will return. So they've gone from silence to a regular level of food noise, but it feels like a much louder level of food noise. So I want to prepare them for that. I do want them to be eating high protein. I'm aiming for around 1.8 grams of protein per kilo of body weight. I do want them on a high fiber diet of 30 grams a day. And then the adequate hydration. We forget about this piece, but it's so important. Aiming for around 40 mil of water per kilogram of body weight. And of course, daily movement of 45 minutes. So that's what I see working clinically to keep that rebound weight off. When patients are on these medications, there's no way they're going to be able to eat 1.8 grams of protein per kilo. And there's no way they're going to be eating 30 grams of fiber a day. So it really is the offboarding that I'm focusing on, as well as the quality of their nutrition while they're on these medications. Mick, what are your thoughts on GLP-1s? What do you see?
Oh, I think we're going to see a tsunami of these medications in the next few years. I mentioned in part one that I do a little bit of point of care testing in the community. And I was at a regional footy match earlier this year, and I tested a bloke who had been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes for over 10 years. Now, he started on semaglutide around about 12, 18 months before, and I measured his HbA1c at 5.2. So I've tested people before that have had type 2 diabetes, and I've never seen really anyone below 6.5 on traditional hypoglycemic. So I think that alone speaks volumes as to why these types of medications are just going to grow in the community. I can report that there are currently 10 phase 2 and phase 3 trials on new GLP-1 receptor agonists that display various levels of weight loss and other effects to the body. I should say, though, there has been some tests on oral semaglutide, but the side effects are quite high. Around about 52% of the people that did it experienced nausea, 24% experienced vomiting, and 28% diarrhea. So I don't think there's going to be any oral semaglutide anytime soon. One drug that was quite good in the trials was orforglipron. It's currently in phase 2 trials due to finish in October 2027. It's an oral GLP-1 receptor agonist. You can lose up to 14% of your weight on that, and it does only have mild gastrointestinal effects. Its half-life is around 29 to 49 hours, so looks like it'll be once-a-day dosing, which is good for compliance. So that's an exciting one at the moment. There's retatrutide. Now, this is a triple pathway drug. This is a GLP-1, a GIP, and a glucagon receptor agonist. So, interestingly, the gastrointestinal effects are still quite high, causing around 16% of the participants in the current trial to leave. And the current trial is due to finish in May 2026. However, it does offer slightly better weight loss than either semaglutide or tirzepatide. It can reduce your weight by up to 24%, whereas tirzepatide is around 22% and semaglutide 17.4%. Now, it's not all about the weight loss. It should be about a healthy weight level and body composition. And this is where a monoclonal antibody called bimagrumab has been shown to stimulate skeletal muscle growth and improve body composition. Now, in a 48-week phase two trial, it was associated with a 20.5% reduction in fat mass and a 3.6% increase in lean muscle mass. So at the end of the trial, the participants had around about a 6.5% total weight loss, which, you know, when you're looking at putting muscle on and it weighs more than fat, that sort of makes sense. So it was all about body composition. But interestingly, it's now in another phase two trial and it's being combined with semaglutide. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. So my thoughts are that these will become part of the landscape, cardiometabolic landscape. So when people have issues, they'll either be put on an antihypertensive, something for cholesterol, and something for body composition, whichever way it comes out.
I'm glad you mentioned the skeletal muscle loss there, because it's one of my bugbears with these medications, particularly because in my patient demographic, working with women often in this perimenopausal, menopausal age, or even preconception, the loss of muscle is the worst thing they could do for their health. So I really do, all the naturopathic strategies possible, but at the same time, these medications do tend to lower muscle regardless.
I was just going to say, so yes, you're absolutely correct. Muscle loss means bone density loss. So that's what it's all about.
Exactly. Michelle, as a doctor, I'd love to get your perspective here.
I mean, I love this discussion too, because I've never really seen a drug that has had such a significant kind of game changer impact in my 30 years of practice. And I think GLP-1s, it's good to note they've been around for about 20 years. So at least we can have a little bit of, trust in their safety, longer term. But I think it's really important to recognise that they aren't for everyone. Of course, there's a fairly big financial contribution, and that really puts them out of reach for many people. But in a recent trial that was published called the Step 5 trial, they found that patients taking 2.4 milligrams of semaglutide found that about 25% experienced less than a 5% reduction in body weight. And what that kind of suggests, is what Emma and Lisa were talking about, is this: they're not just a quick fix. You go on the medication and you lose it. It really does require that holistic, lifestyle-orientated approach. And certainly what we found is that, when people stop taking these medications, there's a very significant increase in weight regain, which is, now people are saying, well, you're going to need to be on them for life. And if you think about the financial implications of that, then, it's a significant factor. But one trial that came out just in 2024 called the TOWARD trial, I think everybody really should know about this. And TOWARD stands for Text-Based Communication and Messaging. The O is online interactions. The W is wellness coaching. The A is asynchronous education. R was remote monitoring and body composition. And D was dietary modification. So that's what it stood for. And some research out of the UK and the US actually showed that when these medications, or even a deprescription of these medications, It was the coaching, the asynchronous messaging, the accountability, the education, the low carbohydrate, you know, approach, which fits in with like a Mediterranean diet, you know, high in fiber, encouragement of exercise, looking at that psychological or emotional eating pattern. And that was associated with a significant weight loss that was equal to the GLP-1s and that was sustained for over 12 months after that. And you're right, actually, mentioning this loss of muscle mass, which is a big issue. I mean, obviously, if you're losing 20, 30 or 40 kilograms of weight, which some people are doing, there's a natural decrease in lean muscle mass required. You know, a lot of people that are in the obese category actually have very hypertrophic gastrocnemius muscles in which to kind of stabilize them. So it's naturally if they don't need them anymore that lean muscle mass will decrease. But I'm very concerned about that, and I think that introduction of muscle building has to be foundational. And I think what you can do is really almost delay the introduction of GLP-1s by a couple of months to establish some of these better behavioural interventions and then use the GLP-1s with a kind of mindset of, you know, use maybe it's 6 months, maybe it's 12 months, maybe it's 18 months, depending upon that person's need, with the idea that there's that eventual coming off these or de-prescription process, a little bit like we, you know, are meant to kind of say with antidepressants, is like you might use an antidepressant, but really the bulk of the intervention is around the psychological understanding and skills and changes in mindset that come with it. Like, you know, they have the same kind of philosophy with ADHD medications as well. So like this, you know, 10% pills, you know, 90% skills kind of thing. And I think that we've got to think about GLP-1s in that regard as well, because the skill aspect and the social aspect and the changing in relationship to lifestyle as a medicine is such a powerful underlying principle that will help to sustain that cardiometabolic impact, which is why we're using them in the first place.
Great reminder there and some really good insights. I think the patients that see me, they either fall into the, I'm going to use it for 6 weeks because I've got an event on, or they think they're going to be on it forever. And what you're really counselling is this middle ground of where we can prep well for the use of it, we can onboard it for a determined period of time and then offboard it in a way that works for this long-term health of that cardiometabolic system.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I recently read a small 2024 study involving only 40 patients, but what it showed is that over 16 weeks, statins can cause a sharp drop of natural GLP-1 production up to 50% due to the impact of GLP-1s on the microbiome. So there's a complex interplay here. Mick, can you tell us a little bit more about statins?
Yeah, I had a look at that study too, that 2024 study. What happened is there was an inhibition or reduction in Clostridium in the gut, and that reduced levels of ursodeoxycholic acid, one of the bile acids, and this led to the decrease in GLP-1 levels because ursodeoxycholic acid stimulates L cells in the ileum, which promote GLP-1 secretion. So that's what was going on in that process there. But in a general sense, statins can actually have an effect on or make you more prone to, say, cardiometabolic disease and type 2 diabetes. And they can do it in basically a two-step process. Firstly, statins can impair insulin secretion by increasing cholesterol buildup in pancreatic beta cells, and this leads to some form of dysfunction there. They also promote insulin resistance by disrupting glucose uptake in muscles and increasing glucose production in the liver. And these effects have been shown in both in vivo animal studies and in vitro studies. So in human trials, we tend to see this mainly in high-potency statins at high doses, things like atorvastatin and rosuvastatin. So that's the process there. But you may or may not be aware that there is a new drug that might become an alternative to statins. It's called bempedoic acid. Now, bempedoic acid is available overseas. What it does, it inhibits ATP citrate lyase, which is a key enzyme in cholesterol synthesis. So in a nutshell, ATP citrate lyase generates the acetyl coenzyme A of HMG coenzyme A reductase, so part of that molecule. And of course, statins block the HMG CoA reductase. So bempedoic acid's a prodrug and needs to be activated by an enzyme, and this enzyme is mainly found in the liver and is totally absent in the skeletal muscle. So we don't see these SARMs or skeletal muscle effects with this particular medication. It reduces cholesterol synthesis and increases LDL receptor expression to enhance the clearance of LDL from the blood. It also reduces gluconeogenesis, so it does an opposite effect to what the statins can potentially do, and also reduces fatty acid synthesis and systemic inflammation, so reduces C-reactive protein. So some of these are all quite good positive metabolic markers that we see. On its own, it can reduce LDL by around 30%. If they combine it with ezetimibe, another drug, it goes up to 45%. So still not quite as good as statins. They can reduce cholesterol or LDL as much as 50%. And there have been some side effects associated with it. It can potentially cause gout and has been known in some of the trials to cause tendon rupture. So there are some issues with it. So will it knock off statins at the moment? I don't think so, but I do think as time goes on, this is the first of its class. I think that as time goes on, they'll probably get something that will be more effective with less side effects. So, yeah, they're all looking at ways to try and reduce these downsides with statins.
Okay, perfect. So a zoom out summary on this. Lisa, you talked about the lack of food noise when you're on a GLP-1, but also the risk of undereating. I talked about the strategies that I'm using in clinic to get results for patients both during and then after medication use. Mick, you pointed out the research on GLP-1s and the potential new class of medication to address the muscle loss, plus the statins and the new drugs coming on that front. Michelle lovingly highlighted the risk of rebound weight and how a coaching style program could give better results long term. And I have to say, I couldn't agree with you more. Now, before I go any further, a quick reminder, you can find all the show notes, transcripts and other resources from today's episode on the FX Medicine by Bioceuticals website. Now, to bring both part one and part two of our discussion on cardiometabolic health to life, let's share a case study and how each of you approach it clinically. Lisa, can you tell us about your case?
I can. So I had a female patient, age 40, 130 kilograms, 173 centimetres, so calculated BMI was 43.4, categorised as obese. Now, she presented wanting assistance with low energy, glucose control and weight loss. She was taking 1 gram of metformin per day plus 1 mil of Ozempic weekly. Her vitamin D was 48 and her markers of inflammation, so her ESR and CRP, were both elevated. Liver function was normal. There was a strong family history of stroke, diabetes and heart disease. Now, she also had 3 small children and was studying full time, so the mental load was quite high. Her appetite was quite low in the morning, which I don't find uncommon where there's issues with glucose control. There's lots of meal skipping and forgetting to eat till 2 p.m, but she would prepare everything for the kids. And then she reported stress, eating and binge eating snacks at night. Her dietary recall was very high in refined carbohydrates and inflammatory fats at night, so lots of pasta, lots of cream. And she was very sedentary due to low motivation and low energy. And I'm very interested to hear Adrian's thoughts here on how to motivate, because this is where she really, really struggled. She actually had a little dog who I thought would be and empower her to walk the dog. But she reported even having difficulty and feeling guilty because she would see the dog and he would want to be taken for a walk, but she just couldn't find the motivation to do that. So the goals for me were to assist with the sustained energy throughout the day, blood glucose control, reverse the insulin resistance and elevated cholesterol, weight management, definitely lots of stress support, gut health due to the fact that she also had lots of diarrhea and low appetite. and manage the inflammation and correct the vitamin D deficiency. So, of course, I'm not going to do all of that in the first session. For the first session, I chose to focus primarily on diet for 2 weeks, hoping that she'd be able to make some changes and then we could add more as the sessions continued. So my first recommendation was around eating breakfast. So avoid skipping breakfast, start making it every day when she made breakfast for the kids and eat it with them before she took them to school. The emphasis was on a protein-rich breakfast with some slow-release carbohydrates and also plenty of fibre. We know that fibre actually is incredibly important for the gut microbiome, obviously. And when we consume fibre, we actually increase natural GLP-1 secretion from the gut. So again, thinking about our patient long-term being able to wean off these medications, we're trying to use our food as medicine for natural GLP-1 production. I also thought by having breakfast, this would help to improve her stress adaptation with better blood glucose control and decreased release of that high insulin, which comes from meal skipping. The second recommendation was to add a vinegar dressing to lunch and dinner. I love apple cider vinegar as a food as medicine recommendation for individuals who have insulin resistance or type 2 diabetes. The research shows that at least 15 mils of vinegar consumed with lunch and dinner for 8+ weeks reduces fasting plasma glucose and HbA1c concentrations. So vinegar does this by delaying gastric emptying, enhancing glucose uptake into the cells, and helping to break down fat in the meal. It also suppresses hepatic glucose production and facilitates insulin secretion. So then I focused on lifestyle, walking daily for 15 minutes. And we were just starting really slow because often I think we find that when we just say to our patients, I just want you to do 10 or 15 minutes, hopefully they will do longer. And the goal was to do this earlier in the day when her energy and motivation was higher, and then to take the kids at the weekend and the dog to the beach, which we live close by, to hopefully make it more of a family kind of interaction. My suggestion was to download a step tracker on her phone to increase the motivation because, again, lots of patients feel motivated when they can see the number of those steps going up. And then my last recommendation was to implement a wind down routine in the evenings to reduce that binge eating and sleep by 10 o'clock. So she was studying and doing all her assignments after putting the kids to bed, and, you know, bathing the kids in that bedtime really increased her stress response, as anyone with small children, particularly 3, would understand. So the recommendation was to put the children to bed, do the computer work, shower, which was a recalibration time, a little bit of time on the couch and the TV, which was her downtime, and then a portion control snack. So instead of getting the big bag of chips out that had, you know, 6 servings in it and eating it all, have a snack size pack of chips or chocolate to reduce that overeating. So we know that chronic stress and sympathetic dominance can cause suppression of insulin mediated glycogenesis, leading to hyperglycemia. In the presence of stress hormones, the response to insulin is blocked, resulting in a reduction to the skeletal muscles and their inability to absorb glucose, increasing blood glucose levels. So stress hormones also prevent cells in the pancreas from producing and secreting insulin, and then that lack of sleep on top of it, because she's staying awake late writing these assignments, leads to dysregulation of circadian rhythm, higher cortisol, and an increase in inflammation. So all these factors contribute to where the patient was at.
What a vicious cycle. Mm. I'm just thinking in my mind that it all just feeds into the next step of this vicious circle that she's on. This is a really complicated case. Michelle, what are your thoughts here?
I agree. I think it's a very complicated case, and she's very brave, you know, to want to address it at a time where she's really studying and she's got 3 small children. And so in many ways, I think it's really worth highlighting that there is a part of her that really wants this, despite, you know, another part that is really lacking in motivation and, I guess, a feeling of overwhelm, because it's obviously, it feeds into each other, you know, all of these kind of factors give that vicious cycle impact. But this is where actually introducing the concept of a CGM can be really so incredible, because it gives that real-time insight into her choices. And certainly the research actually shows us that when you see it in real time, you can activate in real time. So that could be a really great idea to introduce that even once or twice, to kind of give her an understanding of the impact of those choices, particularly in the evening, and show her the impact of poor sleep and her stresses, et cetera, on that glucose dyslipidemia, and teach her that educational sort of impact. And then obviously that asynchronous coaching. You know, we know that there's a lot of research now about this opportunity to use technology in our clinics to a much greater effect. I started using asynchronous texting probably about a decade ago, and the impact was actually profound. This wasn't AI, this was before AI, but it felt like they had me in their pocket as a coach. And it was quite a profound implication in terms of like getting them to exercise and changing their diet. So that could be something that may be cost effective for her, to look at some of the coaching programs that are online that are affordable and help her with that accountability piece in this early stage of behavioural change.
Mm, yeah, lots of support needed on all those fronts. Mm. Mick, what are your thoughts first up here?
I agree with Michelle and Lisa. This is a very, very complex case. I guess when someone comes in, and I do see people like this in the pharmacy, when someone comes in, I usually ask them, you know, what's the most important thing at the moment, or what's the thing that's, or I try and work out what's going to have the most serious effect on their health that needs to be addressed first. I was going to ask a couple of questions, things like family history of hypertension. Is this person at risk of hypertension because of the family history of strokes, et cetera? Are they, and I assume they're not on medication for that. Did they say anything about that, Lisa?
No hypertension.
That's good. Oh, good. Then, and I'm assuming that you probably would have done some TMAO testing as well. I would wonder, with this person, I'd certainly be concerned that there may be some kind of, you know, with type 2 diabetes, an increased risk of chronic kidney disease. So I'd look at maybe recommending something like N-acetylcysteine, 600 milligrams once a day. Certainly the use of some antioxidants, resveratrol, even, you know, 200 milligrams a day to help with reducing some of these, you know, things like C-reactive protein, et cetera. Even a simple thing like probiotics you could use, because, you know, some of her presentation sounds a little bit like IBS with the diarrhea, and we know that there can be implications with the microbiome as well. So probiotics, and definitely if she's on metformin, I'd probably ask about her B12 levels, as well as magnesium, and maybe we know that metformin can reduce your B12 levels anywhere from 7 to 35% long term, and that was in people with PCOS as well as type 2 diabetes. So certainly have a look at B12 levels as well.
Okay, perfect. And then, Adrian, I would love to get your input, as would Lisa, on the motivational side of things. If you're working with a case study like this, where do you start?
Yeah, I think it's really important to really spend some time trying to identify some of the barriers to change. You know, what's going on from an environmental perspective, from a psychological perspective, from a lifestyle perspective, and even from a physical perspective that's stopping change. So I think, you know, asking about exercise and reasons why she's not able to exercise and those types of things are really important. And just to assess also, you know, the stages of change, we always go back to kind of where she's, you know, your stage of change model, or is she at pre-contemplation stage, contemplation stage, you know, those types of things are really important. And then, you know, just developing just small steps in terms of changes over time. The other thing I've noticed is, you know, certainly binge eating. I mean, if people are concerned about eating, the other thing to consider is psychological treatment for binge eating. There's certainly very effective treatments for binge eating, and, you know, there's cognitive behavioural therapy that, you know, looks at kind of your thoughts and your triggers and your negative self-talk and increasing food choices. And then, you know, developing a really good self-care plan, I think that's really, really important. And to just, again, think about those types of things that she can do to help improve her overall self-care. And then finally, you've got your different cortisol-regulating herbs, you know, potentially your magnesium, your omega-3s, your vitamin C, your ashwagandha, your L-theanine. Those types of things are always really good options for her to consider if she's struggling from a stress perspective. And then, you know, even from a sleep perspective, your sleep-promoting ingredients like magnesium, glycine, L-theanine again, saffron, those types of things are really good. And if she really has trouble falling asleep, she could read one of Mick's papers that he's been talking about with regards to the medications. I'm sure that she'll really fall asleep really quickly then.
Therapeutic boredom.
That's right. That's right. But when we're thinking about standout complementary medicines, Lisa, what did you actually give her? Talk us through what you did and why.
Okay, so Adrienne, you were spot on. I did actually give her withania for that cortisol aspect and to help her adapt to stress. It's a beautiful nervine, an anxiolytic. I also gave her gotcha cola, which is one of my favourite herbs, another grounding nervine and adaptogen, because I really felt that the HPA axis dysfunction was a primary driver in the binge eating and a lot of the things that were happening for her. I also gave her St. Mary's thistle, which we know is a really good hepatoprotective, but a lot of people don't know it's also great for improving insulin sensitivity. It's also a gentle bitter, so I felt like maybe it would help to increase her appetite a little bit. The other herb I gave her was nigella, which is one of my favourite herbs to use for thyroid dysregulation, which she didn't have. Within the research, I'm familiar with nigella for improving thyroid function, increasing T4 and T3 and reducing cholesterol in hypothyroid patients. I didn't actually know that it also improves metabolic health in individuals who have a lot of diabetes, hypertension, and elevated blood lipids, even if they don't have a thyroid issue. So great research, heaps and heaps of research on PubMed if you want to go have a look. Systematic review, meta-analysis in individuals with type 2 diabetes showing decreased blood pressure, improved glucose control, improved lipid profile in individuals taking nigella. So it really is a standout herb in the cardiometabolic space for me. So that was the herbal formula. I also gave her a vitamin D supplement, 5,000 IU a day, because her levels were so low. And even though I'd made the recommendation around getting outside for the walk and the beach, that was a work in progress.
Yeah, and you want to get those levels up faster than what yes. that alone can do. Mm-hmm. And we know from the literature that overweight people will uptake that vitamin D from a serum perspective more slowly because it needs to saturate the adipose tissue first. So going with that higher dose really makes sense. Michelle, what would you have done in this case in as far as any other complementary medicines that you think are indicated for this patient?
Yeah, well, I agree with Lisa. I think stress is such an underlying driver, and this woman having significant adiposity, she really has to unwind this dense kind of issue slowly. And, you know, I think that psychological support and really kind of calling this out for her in terms of her bravery and how long it's going to take. Obviously, looking at the dose of Ozempic, that could be increased, or she may even want to sort of swap it to a Mounjaro, which has that dual effect and has, I guess, in the research, the chance of increased weight loss over the longer term. So that's something that she could get to have a few wins on the board that might help her with her motivation. It feels like she's on that Ozempic and it's not really being used in the right kind of way that's going to, and it's an expense as well. So that means she probably has to divert funds elsewhere. But certainly I love the fact that you've supported her liver function, which even though she had normal liver function tests, it's likely that she has underlying fatty liver given the level of obesity that she has. But I also like berberine as a complementary medicine to help her with that glucose dysregulation that she's likely to have given the fact that she's got such significant adiposity. And I also love a lot of the basics in terms of things like a B-group vitamin to help with her nervous system and her HPA axis. And likely because of the poor diet that she does have, you know, high in saturated fat and pastas and carbohydrate-rich kind of foods. And B3 can help with appetite regulation as well. So Things like that that are simple and cost-effective can go a long way to help this woman, really, who sounds like she's at the start of her journey, and it will be a long time, and really calling out the bravery that it is going to take and the psychological change and social support that's going to be required for her.
Well put. I think the, you know, us being a cheerleader in their corner, no matter what kind of health practitioner we are, is so important. And just to meet the patient where they're at, she is not going to be able to onboard a lot. And I love, Lisa, that you started with diet alone initially, because it can be very overwhelming for patients when we do too much or ask too much of them. Anyone have any other complementary medicines that haven't been brought up yet? Mick, was there anything else for you?
Look, I think I might have mentioned it in my little bit before, but really, might consider a probiotic with this person, particularly if she's, I mean, the diarrhea could be from the metformin. Maybe look at dose adjustment on the metformin. If she's on, maybe like as Michelle said, maybe they would increase the dose of the Ozempic, reduce the dose of the metformin, depending on what effect they wanted to do. And ubiquinone for this patient, ubiquinol or ubiquinone, CoQ10.
Perfect. So this case was... Oh, Michelle, sorry, you go.
I was just going to concur. I think I agree with CoQ10 for this person too, just in terms of her energy regulation and protection for her cardiovascular system.
Brilliant. So this was a great case example of what we see every day in clinical practice and the kind of strategies that we would use to improve that cardiometabolic health. Thank you, Lisa, for sharing that case with us. Now, as cardiometabolic health is multifaceted, sometimes we need to think outside the box. What are some innovative ideas when it comes to treatment? How do we bring lasting change to a patient that just wants a pill or a supplement to fix their problem? Adrian, I have to start with you now. What do you think is important here?
Yeah, you mentioned lasting change, and I think that's really, really important. And one of the things I want people to think about is relapse prevention. So often people can get things right and start making some really positive changes in their behaviour, but then they kind of relapse and they kind of start changing their behaviours and going back to reverting back to old habits. So I think it's really, really important for us as practitioners to spend some time developing a relapse prevention plan with our clients, talking about high-risk situations, high-risk times, particular emotions, particular people, particular places, or even physical states that might trigger a lapse and frame it that as a lapse as opposed to a relapse. And developing a plan to help manage those high-risk situations, and they could be it could be even, you know, like Christmas time and things like that. So, you know, how do you manage those situations? How do you manage vacations? And often what will happen is people will kind of revert back to old habits and then they start engaging in negative self-talk and go, oh, I've done it again, I failed, and then they never revert back to getting back on track again. So I really encourage people to spend some time after some change has occurred and they're doing really well to not just leave it at that, but speak to your clients about relapse, high-risk situations, and how to manage those situations.
I love the insight there around Christmas or times like that, because you hear it all the time. Patient will go on holiday and then they come back and all their good habits have gone to the wayside and they're feeling the worse for it. But it is so common. So having those front-loaded conversations around those circumstances would be so beneficial.
Definitely.
Now, Mick, are there any strategies you see working well in clinical practice?
I like a quick win, and that gets the patient to get more buy-in to what we're trying to achieve. With this particular patient, I think Lisa really addressed that quick win really well, where she looked at stress and looked at that aspect of this person's complicated case. And I think if you can get someone less stressed, they'll make more reasonable decisions and they're more willing to make decisions like that. I don't often give lots of supplements, usually one or two at a time, and I work on 4 to 6 week return visits. So I tend to look at ways to help with a particular situation now that would easily get, like as I said, a bit of a quick win, get them more better buy-in, and then they'll come back and we can address the next aspect of things. That's how I tend to look at it.
A very considered approach, layering things like that. It's beautiful. Lisa, any tips for us on how you manage this kind of thing clinically?
Yeah, look, I think a lot of patients, and me included, we would love a quick solution to our problem. But the reality is that if something sounds too good to be true, it usually is, right? So yeah. I think education is really, really important here about that long-term kind of view of how things are going to run. And I don't think we can underestimate our interaction with the patient too, because we know when clients feel supported and understood and like we're on their side, that's going to improve better outcomes for the patient too. I think a really important factor that needs to be considered when I'm talking to patients is their relationship around food and the choices they make. So I'm really trying to get my patients to move away from rigid eating practices that really are destined for failure and promote more understanding of their relationship with the food and the decisions they make around food. So often patients think that they lack willpower, that there's a problem with me, but really the problem has been with the restrictive eating practices that they've been utilising, because they're never going to work for that long-lasting change that Adrian discussed. So I think I love the idea of the relapse prevention and this idea of progress over perfection. So I think understanding more about this rather than just recommending patients should eat this and that and expecting them to be able to implement that change needs to be considered too.
Great reminder. And it's a very respectful way to work. I really appreciate that. Michelle, what do you think is missing when treating tricky cases?
I love what everybody said, and particularly Adrian's, really almost proactive discussion around relapse, which is inevitable because, we're humans and celebration times and inclusivity is really important. But, what I've really had a focus on in the last, quite a long time, I guess decade or whatever, is this understanding of the implication of social and environmental factors in people's decision-making, in their sense of community, in their sense of belonging. And often what you find with people that carry weight for a long period of time is that there's often a social implication of that. You know, people share cake together, or they love eating, socially together. And when one person in that community starts to lose weight, there's often a bit of a pushback to the other people in that community if they're carrying a lot of weight. And there was a very famous example of how community support and this sense of social medicine worked. And it was a time, it happened in Chicago. It was called the Daniel Plan. And there was a pastor who was very charismatic, and he had about 15,000 people in his congregation. And the majority of them were carrying excessive weight, including himself. And he teamed up with Mark Hyman, who many people would know is an integrative doctor, and Daniel Amen, who's an integrative psychiatrist, and Dr. Oz. And they arranged this, model where they would meet every Wednesday evening at the church in small groups, and somebody became like a champion of that particular group. And they were there to support each other and share ideas and, how did they, manage that particular setback, or did they do something new that particular week? And so it was very social and people really enjoyed it. And what was amazing is they collectively lost, as a group of people, 110,000 kilograms.
Wow.
And, I know around Australia actually, like the Cleveland Clinic and the Mayo Clinic have introduced this concept of shared medical appointments, bringing kind of communities of people that have the same sort of issues, so whether it's obesity or type 2 diabetes or, maybe it's osteoarthritis or something like that. So they share a commonality and they come together and they share ideas. And often what happens with these groups is that one person's at a different level, or they've had a particularly good week and one person's had a particularly not so good week, and they support each other. And so it's less about the hierarchical, the practitioner knows more than me, but more actually about that community and social implication. And the results of that, of doing medicine in that shared setting, in that co-regulation kind of style, is really profound. It's hard to get people to actually join that because there's a bit of a shame filter that, you know, stops them from doing that. But once you get them there, the success rate or the positivity rate is around 92.7% where people will want to come back and they find it very, very beneficial. And I think that, you know, as prackies, you know, in Lisa's terms, prackies, I love it, is like we really, like we've got big issues here. We've got big epidemics, you know, of cardiometabolic issues with epidemics of obesity, and if we rally together and support each other at a deeper level, I think we can get some really incredible results.
Well, I don't know many interventions that have a success rate of over 90%. So that alone is absolutely incredible when you're thinking about, you know, nutritional supplements, herbs, you know, pharmaceuticals. To have that level of success means that there is something in it we need to learn.
I agree.
So to summarise this section, Adrian gave us some very valuable insights into having those proactive conversations around relapse and also reframing setbacks. Mick suggested that we use some realistic timeframes and definitely get that quick win on the board straight away to build the rapport and the compliance. Lisa reminded us that we need to emphasise education with patients as knowledge really is power. And then Michelle, you finished with the power of a community and social connection in compliance and that long-lasting change. We've almost done it, team. We have almost got through this incredibly huge topic. Last question I have for you is, I would love to know what your favourite app, book or any other resource or tool is when it comes to cardiometabolic health. Mine absolutely has to be the Body Roundness Index, which we will link to in the show notes. So please go there to use that quick free online assessment with your patients. Lisa, what would yours be?
I love podcasts and I love Instagram posts and things like that to be able to send to patients. So in terms of podcasts, I really like Andrew Huberman's podcast. He does a great one, for example, with Dr. Peter Attia. Obviously, the podcasts go for hours and hours and hours, but in terms of sending to clients, you can send them the broken down clips from YouTube, which is 7 minutes. So for example, knowing why your blood pressure is the key to longevity. They're presented in an easy to understand manner and just reiterate really what we've talked about in the consult. So for me, they're filled with actionable steps. They cover topics such as ApoB, which many clients are just not aware of. And generally, they're quite balanced. So I like to add those in my email that goes along with the prescription just to enhance what we've talked about.
I love that. Education, education, education. That's so important. Adrian, what do you like to use?
Yeah, I think there's some great apps out there and particularly around mindful eating and managing cravings and goal setting. I think there's some great options for people to download and try and really just try for a little while, see if it kind of works for them. Not one an app might be a preference for one person and then somebody else may not like it. They prefer a different one. So I would try different things, download them. Hopefully they're free. And utilise those. I think they're good options. And then obviously learning more about habits and behaviour change, I think, is always really good. So books like Atomic Habits, and there's another one called Tiny Habits, which are also good behaviour change books to consider.
Fantastic. Thank you. Mick, what's your preference for apps, books, resources?
I think if someone wants to keep a check on their cardiometabolic metrics, I think you can go into pharmacies and use those health stations that are in there. Yeah, I think just something as simple as that. In terms of books, I think there was one book that I looked at called Mindset, which was really either a growth or a fixed mindset. And I think that is an incredibly good book to help you understand that, you know, sometimes you need help from other people in order to achieve what you need to do and not to think that you can do it all yourself.
Excellent. Wonderful. And Michelle, what's your favourite tool or resource?
Well, there's a lovely little app called Body Map, which is MAPP. And that is a little bit like Mick's suggestion of using the Sisu stations at Priceline pharmacies and those kind of things. But what it does is it uses the heat sensor of the the phone, so the same as the face recognition technology in a phone, and you can get a really good assessment of your visceral fat based on that, which is quite confronting if you know when I used it. But it also gives you a really nice record, because obviously getting visceral fat proper assessments are expensive and require you to kind of go elsewhere. But this is like in your phone, it's quite strongly correlated. But I also love the work of Michael Mosley, rest in peace, gorgeous man, who I think really made just such a phenomenal difference in this space. And his books are so approachable and so encouraging. And I know his cookbook, which is The Fast 800, and not necessarily advocating 800 calories, but a lot of those recipes are so simple, easy. They really kind of appeal to people that are busy and, you know, and have to cook a nutritious meal at night. So, and then a lot of his podcasts or TV shows just, you know, really have created a different way for people to really look at their cardiometabolic health. So, yeah, I think he was a wonderful gift to the world.
I have to concur. He brought a lot of education to the world. So we have the Body Map app and Michael Mosley as being your two resources. So now that we're at the end of our second episode on cardiometabolic health, we have covered treatment in this episode. I'd just like a one sentence from each of you around what stands out for you from today's discussion on treatment. Lisa, let's go.
Well, I think what I've learned today is that treatment is multifaceted. There's so many different things that we can recommend, but of course, we always have to think about the client and apply that client-centered approach.
Perfect. And Adrian?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's the multidisciplinary approach, you know, the fact that you've got all these different practitioners and utilise the different skills that we have. And I think today's has shown that naturopaths and GPs and pharmacists and psychologists have just a great different approaches and different ideas that they can help our clients.
Perfect. Mick, what's your parting words?
The mind is just as powerful as the physical things that we do. So that is the biggest thing I took away from today.
Perfect. And Michelle, to finish off?
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with everything everyone said, like that multifactorial, patient-centric approach, but really including the psychological factors and the social factors to really bring it home for that person. Like, we spend a lot of time thinking about individuals, but if we think about how that individual interrelates with their community and their environment, really brings a whole different flavour to clinical practice.
Perfect. Well, thank you for sharing your expertise today, team. We've covered an amazing amount of information, which I'm sure our audience will find extremely valuable. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Emma.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everyone, for listening today. Don't forget that you can find all the show notes, transcripts, and other resources from today's episode on the FX Medicine by Bioceuticals website. I'm Emma Sutherland. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. This podcast is intended as healthcare practitioner education only, and it is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to FX Medicine, and share us with your family, friends, and colleagues.